This is a forum on the subject, civil disobedience, is it an option or an obligation for Christians? I want to say a word at the very outset about forums at Holden, about the process. I'm aware that people come into the village and go out on a regular basis, and it might be helpful just to say something about the character of a forum at Holden as a way of inviting your participation. It's a trait of this place, and has been for these 25 years, to welcome the airing of serious, often controversial issues. That has been done in the conviction that deeper bonds of faith permit us to gather as a community of moral deliberation on serious issues. The ground rule for such forums is a simple one, namely that we should respect one another by welcoming whatever views happen to be present in this room. The procedure for tonight's forum is that we've got three opening responses to the question. I won't even call you folks panelists, because, or at least not in any different way than everyone out there and in this room and up there in the balcony is a panelist. But there are three personal statements. We'll ask for 5 minutes or thereabouts from each of the three persons here. And then there will be an opportunity for you to add whatever it is that you think needs to be added to those three statements. It may be an entirely different perspective that is invited. After we have that opportunity to get a range of views in response to this question into the public arena, then we'll go at the response in a free-willing sort of way to the views expressed. But the first part of this is just to get three statements. Now, I can see most of the folks down here. I can see some of you up there. But people in the balcony, please simply speak up. And in the event I don't see a raised hand, please just speak up. Maggie Ferris is going to lead off. She's the nurse at Holden at present. Barry Shelley, who gave leadership, as you know, to Vespers this evening, is a program associate at Holden. And Mark Edwards is on the teaching staff at present. He has been teaching at Purdue in history and now is moving to Harvard. My name is Larry Rasmussen. My task is simply to direct traffic and perhaps an occasionally to pose a question or make a connection. So let's just dive in. The question is, civil disobedience, is it an option, obligation for Christians? Maggie?
Okay, I'm going to start with just talking about how I got involved with civil disobedience and then answer the question. I wish I could say that as a Christian out of my deep prayer life, I came to the position of resistance. But that's not the way it happened. I was in a church one day just before Lent, about 5-6 years ago, praying, trying to figure out what was going to be my Lenten journey for the next 40 days. It was the day before Ash Wednesday. And as I was praying, there was a nun that walked up to me. This was a Catholic church. And she introduced herself, and she said to me, well, you know, what's your name? And I told her my name. And she said, well, what do you do? And I said, I'm a nurse. I'm a mother of four. And then she said, she was a nun in habit, kind of an older woman. And she said to me, well, what are you doing to end the arms race? And I looked at her and I said, well, I write letters. And she said, well, did you ever think of civil disobedience? And I said, well, maybe you didn't hear me. I'm a nurse and I'm a mother. And she said, well, yeah, that's why you should be doing it. And then she proceeded to tell me about the March on Washington, the New York rally in 1982. And I can remember walking home that day in the snow and just kind of kicking the snow and thinking, who is this nun woman to say this to me, and a nurse and a mother, that I should be doing civil disobedience? And about a week later, I was with my son Nicholas, who was at the time maybe five, in downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul, and there's a big fountain, and we're in a town square, and he asked for 2 pennies. And he made really intent wishes. You know, he flipped these 2 pennies over his shoulder, and my mother and I were together, and he said she probably wished for a bike and a doll, and we're kind of laughing. And later at lunch, my mother said to him, Nicky, what was it that you wished for? And Nick looked at me and he said, well, my first wish was that the poor people would no longer be poor, and my second wish is that there'd never be a nuclear war. And then it just hit me that nun was probably right. And that because I was a mother, that maybe I need to do something a little more seriously. And it hit me that my son, number one, knew the word nuclear, and number two, that he could make that connection between the poor being poor and there being a nuclear war, that he, you know, made those two wishes at once. And it really caused me that Lent to do a lot of praying and reflecting. As a Christian in this country, what are we called to do? How are we called to live? The question is civil disobedience an option? Yes, it's an option. Is it an obligation? I don't think civil disobedience is an obligation, but I think that in our desire and our yearning to follow the example of Christ in this country, we will oftentimes find ourselves doing civil disobedience or going against the laws of this country. That we follow a Christ who told us that we should love our enemies, that we should do good to those who persecute us, that when the only time he talked about the final judgment, he said we need to feed those who are hungry, to clothe those who are naked. And here we find ourselves in this country, which is directly causing immense poverty and pain in Central America and other regions of the world. We find ourselves in a country which is undermining the farm structure for the benefit of the wealthy, and that's arming ourselves with nuclear weapons. Not even so much because they might be used. While I think Dick McSorley, theologian, said that the weapons we use, that the Russians use against us, will destroy our bodies, but the weapons we plan to use against them will destroy our souls. I think there's a very serious obligation intending to use the weapons, but right now if we don't use them, we're committing a war on the poor, because if we were to just divert 10% of the amount of money we're putting into nuclear weapons into food poverty, not one hungry person by the end of the century. I think we're also committing a psychological warfare on our children, that kids these days in high school don't believe that they may even grow to have children. It's undermining the psychological makeup of our kids. So for me, it's not, is it an obligation? I think we're obligated to struggle for justice tirelessly, endlessly. As Dan Berrigan says, and as I think Jack used in one of his homilies, as Christians, we have to always ask, are we going to look good on wood? And I think that's part of the outcome. We need to not ask what are the consequences, but how are we going to live no matter what the consequences. The times that I've done civil disobedience and the times that I've spent in jail have been times where my faith has really been tested and has grown. I would not give for anything to be there amongst those who are imprisoned. I learned why Jesus included in Matthew 25 visiting the imprisoned as one of the works of mercy. It was an incredible experience. So that's basically my answer. Civil disobedience probably will be an outcome of our following the model and the example of Christ. It led him to jail, it led him to the cross, and many, many others since him and before us who followed in his footsteps.
Thank you. Okay.
First of all, I'm not going to go through all these notes. These are notes from something I did in the past, and I'm just lifting out a couple ideas. I would agree with everything that Maggie's already said. I have also been involved in civil disobedience in several cases. I've been one of those fortunate persons who tends to be able to break laws that the police don't want to arrest anybody for at the particular time. I've been arrested a couple times, but I've been involved in other things. I won't go into the details about that. It's almost humorous in a way. But I would say that civil disobedience, I'll just say from the outset, is both an obligation in some cases and an option in others. And I guess I want to make a distinction between civil disobedience that breaks laws that are immoral in themselves and civil disobedience that breaks laws that are broken to make a statement about other things that are immoral, where the law itself that's being broken is not necessarily the thing in question. I think that, for example, I think that Rosa Parks refusing to move on the bus in 1956, was an act of almost essentially of obligation in a way. I mean, I think that's the point. I don't think that's what she was consciously thinking at the time. I think she was just fed up. But she was essentially refusing to obey a law that she thought was immoral, that she had to sit in the back of the bus. Whereas the civil disobedience that I've been involved in has been breaking laws like blocking parking lots, a squatters movement in Boston in terms of entering an abandoned house and setting that up for families of people who have no homes, or blocking driveways to the White House, or driveways to the nuclear power plants, or entering federal buildings in Boston around the Pledge of Resistance and Nicaragua struggle. Those are laws that I don't have any problems with, laws that basically say you shouldn't block driveways or parking lots. There's nothing immoral about that law. But I saw civil disobedience in those cases as an option for civil protest. And I guess I do see that as an effective option and one that we really need to consider. I certainly draw a lot from, I think Jesus was involved in civil disobedience all through the New Testament, I mean, all through the Gospel. I mean, he broke all sorts of Sabbath laws. He threw people out of the temple. There's certainly foundation there. There's a lot of other, sort of a whole tradition of material from Gandhi, from Martin Luther King most recently. I guess several concerns about that. First, let me say, I think that it is an effective option. Even when the law you're breaking is not immoral in itself. I think that that sometimes I have felt like you really cannot in good conscience do otherwise than to raise the level of resistance to a point where you're willing to take those kinds of risks. And I really do believe that in the situation right now with Contra Aid, for instance, that it is only going to be when enough Americans are out in the streets making protests that are heard, and civil disobedience, I think, needs to be part of that at least, that anything's going to really change. I think the Vietnam War was an example where it took a long time, but I'm still convinced if it was not for the level of protest and civil disobedience, that the war would not have ended when it did. I think that it can be very important in terms of press and the statement that comes from that, and simply raising the level of consciousness of people is also an important part of it. And I also think it's important for those, I mean, Maggie was talking about the experiences of being arrested. I think we need to be careful in not making that sort of a self-righteous status symbol. But I do believe that there is a empowering in that. I'm fond of quoting A.J. Musty, who is an old social activist back in the 50s and 60s, and there's a story about how he was out with his picket sign in Washington somewhere, I'm not even sure where it was, by himself, walking up and down the street, and some young person came up to him and say, "Mister, you really can't think you're going to change the world by doing this." And he turned around and very slowly said, "Young man, I'm not out here so much to change the world as I am to keep the world from changing me." And I really think that there is a power in a community of people that are willing to take those kinds of actions that keeps us directed and informed, and essentially from the Vespers tonight, keeping us in touch with the grieving of the world. And I think that civil disobedience is one way of doing that. And let me end by saying that I am also very concerned about the abuses of civil disobedience. And I think, unfortunately, that happens more than I would like. I think that there is a real... Let me just go through some of that to end on. I think that there is... that people involved in civil disobedience need to be very conscious of the way it is done. And I cannot go, in the time that we have now, go into detail about all of that, but just things like guidelines about nonviolence, the way decisions are made in a community of people doing civil disobedience, all the checks that you have about what you're doing, how closely related, how creative is it? Is it just simply to go out and break a law? And I found that primarily as when that is done in the religious community, which has been all of my experience out of civil disobedience, primarily, that there is that very conscious effort to keep things focused and not skewed and sort of lose your sense of why you're doing it. But abuses can occur, and I think that some abuses occur when the design provokes a violent reaction even if you don't think yourself that you're being violent. I've had some experience with that in Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, New Hampshire, where I felt like even though people were very self-righteously saying that they were being nonviolent, that the design of the action was such that it was inevitable that it was going to cause a level of anger that was going to create violence, and it did. It did. I did not feel like that was a legitimate approach. I think that civil disobedience can also become trivialized when it is used all the time. And I also think that the laws of the state can be trivialized if you simply go out and break every law you can think of just to be breaking the law. I think a lot of times legal protests can be a lot more effective in certain cases. For instance, I think that Witness for Peace Crosses of Sorrow campaign about 2 years ago was one of the most effective. I won't go into detail what that was, but it involved carrying crosses with the names of people who were killed by Contras through the middle of cities and having very, very quiet vigils. That was perfectly legal. So I think there needs to be a mixture in there so that we don't simply create a situation where the goal becomes one of getting arrested. And I know too many people that go out and it's like this status symbol of how many times you've been arrested. And I think that really trivializes the cause, it trivializes the method as well. And there's really elitism that creeps into those that are involved in civil disobedience and those that aren't. So I think that basically then the end is just to say that I think it has to be done in a real sense of community. For me, that means a religious community that is very, very careful about what it's doing, why, and how it's doing.
Thank you very much. Mark?
I want to argue, at least for the sake of this discussion, that civil disobedience has to be an option and not a necessity. You have to distinguish between civil disobedience and passive resistance. Any Christian, if asked to do something that Christian feels is immoral or against his or her faith, must refuse. That's part of our calling. But beyond that, deciding how to respond to an injustice in society is a judgment that God doesn't give us a ready answer. Barry's been talking about strategies and figuring out how to do civil disobedience in the most effective way. And that is an example of how what we all have to do, that is we have to use our God-given reason to analyze the situation and decide what we think is the most appropriate response. And each of us has to make that decision himself or herself. We're called to be we are called to be faithful, we are not necessarily called to be effective. On the other hand, it would be unfortunate if we were only faithful and never effective. But being effective is a matter of what's called prudence. Prudence is simply our God-given ability to look at the situation, analyze it, and decide what we think we need to do at that particular time. And also, prudence involves weighing the costs of what we're doing and be willing to accept those costs. That means that for some people, responding, for example, to Vietnam, it meant that they tried to find alternate service of some sort. Others tried to avoid fighting through medical discharges or medical exemptions. Others filed for conscientious objector status, some on the basis of a just war argument or a Lutheran position, some on an absolute pacifist position. For some, the decision was that they had to resist and not even cooperate to the extent of registering for the draft or going through the process. I do not feel that I could say any of those positions were wrong. As a draft counselor and a military counselor, that is someone counseling people in the military trying to get out, I often had to tell people that some of these strategies were not going to work as well as others. I had to tell people and help them realize that certain strategies had much more serious consequences than others. But in each case, the individual had to weigh his or her own beliefs and convictions, his or her own evaluation of the situation, and his or her own decision on what seemed to be the best thing to do. So I'd argue that civil disobedience, as opposed to passive resistance or refusal, is always an option, never a necessity, even though I would hope that many people would feel compelled to act in some of the situations we're confronting today.
Thank you. Those have been three responses. The first thing we want to do now, as earlier indicated, is just to ask for any contributions to the spectrum of possible answers to the forum question. In other words, I'm not asking you yet to respond to Maggie, Barry, or Mark's comments so much as to respond directly to the question. Is civil disobedience an option or obligation for Christians if your position has not been articulated yet with these three? What other viewpoints should we have out here on the floor before we go at the general discussion? Okay, we got everybody covered, right? Line them, all right.
One other thing that I think we need to consider is that there, among the different kinds of civil disobedience, there is the public civil disobedience, such as a sitting or picketing or making some kind of a public statement. But there's also a very private kind of civil disobedience where publicity and exposure is the farthest thing that is desired. Such as the sanctuary movement, where publicity for the movement, perhaps, but not for the specific act of civil disobedience, emancipation and the Underground Railroad,
yes,
having the slaves escape, discovery and exposure was the least furthest things from their mind. And I think that's another kind of civil disobedience that might be addressed, where.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still civil disobedience.
Yeah.
And not just to make a political statement,
right,
but to affect some other cause.
Right. Thank you very much. It's an important addition.
Mary?
Yes.
I came in late, but have we talked about corporate or community together? Civil disobedience versus the individual disobedience. Because I was thinking of St. Leo's Parish in Tacoma, where they have a lot of people from Central America, and the whole congregation nurtures and takes care of them, and some of them stay there in that building all the time for fear that they will be picked up if they go outside.
Mm-hmm. So the church is the sanctuary.
The church is the sanctuary. They're a community of doing civil disobedience.
Yeah. Some comment was made, but we didn't make the distinction between community and individual. Barry said it was important to him that there be a religious community of support. But that's a collective decision. Yeah.
Don't we run into a kind of situation ethics here, where the situation demands at a certain moment that you can be disobedient, and another situation you should not. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you, I went to an occupation in Holland by the German army, and there comes a point that you are going to resist and to disobey that so-called, what we call an illegal, but the Germans call a legal government.
Yeah.
So you come in this weighing, on the one hand, yes, and the other hand, and there is no more hand, right? It's still on the roof.
Yeah, you're saying that the question as posed is a question posed in the abstract.
It is.
And in order to answer it, we need to talk about particular cases, because it'll make a difference in our answer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to make a comment, this civil disobedience is an evolutionary process that a lot of us can get stuck in, and a decade passed where we demonstrate for a certain point, and they keep changing the rules on us. An example is the plowshares demonstrations, which had no way of possibly damaging the missile cone underneath that concrete, but they actually labeled it as sabotage, and people ended up with 12 and 14 and 18 year sentences. We have to keep in mind that if we don't have legal counsel before the attempt at many of these occasions, mm-hmm, we're going to be in deeper trouble than we really, the cost may be too much.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people were willing to take that cost. In fact, several of the plowshares demonstrators did not even defend themselves. It was a private kind of demonstration I personally have trouble with. If you're going to demonstrate, it's to make it public to the point, except for the sanctuary,
mm-hmm,
to the point that you want to broadcast this injustice around to everyone. But there were private demonstrations of civil disobedience that are hard to grasp, but they ended up with 10, 12, and 14 year sentences. This is astounding for somebody who expected to be let off in 6 months,
yes,
or have a suspended sentence. So I think it's important to know the evolution of the laws that change, and change in the process of you actually in the middle of your trial, that can get you into such deep water. You have to second guess. This is not 10 years ago sitting down in front of a building kind of thing. So some of these actions are very, very dangerous to your future.
Mm. Thank you, Al.
Larry, I hear that remark, and Roxy's too, pointing to a dimension that's very important in my mind when I think about these things, and that's the communal dimension. That these not usually, except under very extreme circumstances, these usually should not be individual acts. Indeed, they should involve broad involvement of community, not just so that they are publicly visible, so as to be effective. I certainly agree with that as one of the considerations, but the other is so that they be tested against the broader wisdom of the community as a whole. I would be thinking now of a church community or a religious community or a humanitarian community. Bonhoeffer, whom we've been instructed in so well by Larry, I think took great pains to make sure that he wasn't just acting on his own impulse, mm-hmm, but always consulting his sisters and brothers in the beginning of Kierkegaard. I hear a lot of people these days dismissing the activism of the 60s because it was visceral, it wasn't well reflected, and it didn't have staying power. And a lot of people claim that the reason for that was it was not really well thought out communally. So that's just a thought that comes to my mind, that we really must emphasize, if we are involved in civil disobedience, the wisdom of the community to which we belong, to test our tactics and our guiding principles.
Yeah, thank you, Paul.
Just a question. In one of the earlier forums, someone mentioned the defense budget and not paying taxes. And I'm wondering if that is a form of civil disobedience that is very individual and would also be very, very costly to the individual. I don't know if anybody knows very much about that.
Megan, you want to
respond? Civil disobedience would include military tax resistance. I guess I see nonviolence on a spectrum, that one level being protesting the government's policy, another level being non-cooperation, looking at where the unjust policy intersects your life, whether it be, am I going to go into the military service or am I going to pay for our government's policy, and just non-cooperating. And that's a very individual form of civil disobedience. And a lot of people try to band together for support. And there are many ways that you can do that so that you do get the support. Then the third level being direct intervention, intervening in or taking actions that intervene with into our government's policies, whether it be blocking the white train that carries the weapons. But tax resistance is indeed a form of civil disobedience.
Okay.
Just not as quiet, I'm saying it doesn't have to be a form of civil disobedience. One form of tax resistance is to live below the taxable income, which relates to a whole lot of other areas of our lives.
Which is why a lot of us are here right now. We have a whole mother of the state watching for our row of poverty.
There's another Holden volunteer opportunity.
What I would like to know is also, what do people then do with the money they save by not paying taxes?
What we've done in Minneapolis, which has been a really fun form of civil disobedience, is we got together and we dreamt of all the things we wanted to see our government pay for, whether it be educational supplies, there were about 20 of us, whether it be medical supplies, and then we figured out how much was the military portion of our taxes, and we bought those things. And we worked with the federal guards and with the Internal Revenue Service, and we worked out a system where we had a prayer service at the Dorothy Day Center, and then we went through downtown St. Paul with truckloads of life-giving goods. And we covered the whole front of the Internal Revenue Service's building downtown, the regional offices, with filing cabinets for the Indian Health Board, slide projectors and film projectors and food, lots and lots of food and medical supplies and pregnancy test equipment. We all had worked out with social service agencies that needed these. And tried to say very positively, we want to pay, but we just can't trust you with our money because you keep turning it into guns. So here, please accept this. And we each took a portion of what we had bought up to try to pay in like a can of tuna, and then they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't accept the legal tender. And but it really captured the imagination, and that's, I think, a real good act of civil disobedience. We'll be creative and it'll be real visible, like this is what we could be buying. But
true is life.
And then another year we had I baked a huge apple pie, and we did a little skit where we dressed a couple people up. Tom Witt was the Pentagon, and I think I was an MX missile, and we had Senator Duguid, who cut the American pie. We had about 100 people on one side with little signs that said welfare, Department of Health, Education, Welfare, food stamps, all the social programs, and then we had the Pentagon, the Navy, the Army on this side, and we came marching in to the tune of on a boombox, Stars and Stripes Forever, and then Senator Duguid distributed the pie, and he gave us these big pieces, and we just shoved it in our mouths, and then gave everyone else little slices, and then Tom Witt, who was the Pentagon, came over and said, well, we need a little more, and then the senator came and took from the people with the little slivers and gave more to the military. Just to say real visibly, this is unjust, this is crazy, redistribute the money. But then we end up paying twice. Every year we buy this stuff and we end up paying twice because then they garnish our wages or whatever. Here, come back.
I hope you deduct that which you paid as charitable contributions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Free to say something now?
Yeah, no. You all are free to say. This is wide open.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I'd like to address the issue of obligation again. I think I was really clear in my first statement. I think I'm not sure that obligation is even the right word. Maybe even calling might even be a better word. I do not think that and I would agree with Mark in sort of the overall general abstract sense that you cannot say that everyone has an obligation to get involved in civil disobedience. But I really do believe that there are moments in our lives, and some people have those in different ways, that we confront a situation where we really don't have a choice if we're going to be faithful. And if you want to call that an obligation, okay. And I think in some ways that's maybe what you were saying, that it's a situational thing. But I really do believe that it becomes an act of that you really have no choice. That you really don't have a choice if you're going to be faithful. Sure, you have a choice, but and that in a way becomes an obligation in a particular moment, in a particular time, and that may be a matter of civil disobedience. I think that's particularly true when the law itself is immoral. I think the civil rights movement is all part of that. I think Lauren's point is really well taken, that there are a lot of times that laws are broken quietly because they are immoral. I think people in South Africa, we had a couple people here not too long ago from South Africa, I think a lot of people in South Africa, I mean white South Africans as well as black, are in a point where they feel like they have no choice out of a sense of faithfulness other than to break laws. I think certainly people like Alan Bosack and people like that are in that situation. I think for them they would say it's an obligation of faith, that they don't have a choice if they're going to be faithful. So I think that can also be true about breaking laws where you're simply breaking a law that in and of itself is not immoral, but you're breaking a law to make a particular point, and that's the form of resistance that you see at that particular time that you're called to do. And again, in that sense, I think it's an obligation.
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as I've got the heavies rolled here. That individual chooses to see it as an obligation, as his or her faithful response to that particular situation. Each individual has to confront and make that choice himself or herself, this is not merely semantics. It always is a choice. It is always an option, and there's always the decision of how to respond. I mean the fact that you feel obliged to act doesn't mean that you're obliged to act in terms of civil disobedience. The one thing I'm worried about is that we have different talents and different gifts. Some of us may have the stuff of martyrdom. Some of us may have the stuff of prudent civil disobedience. Some of us may be less bold or see our calling in some other way. Or, for example, supporting those people who are willing to be out on the front line. But not willing to take, or do not feel the call to take that risk themselves. Like the 12 or 14 year prison terms, it seems to me that many people who are not going to be involved in the protest directly might feel a very strong sense that they have to do something to help those people. But they're not involved in civil disobedience themselves, but they are involved in helping others. And I think that if we say you are obliged to act in certain things, and then you define, for example, Nicaragua as being, as I personally believe it is, as horrible as it is, and you say that you're obliged to act, and then the group decides there's a certain narrow range of actions, then you may be excluding a lot of people. You may be losing people. You may be telling people that they are unfaithful unless they act on your vision of what's the appropriate thing to do. And I think that just as no one else can believe for me, no one else can die for me, no one else can decide what I feel, or what one feels, is necessary.
Let me just very briefly respond to that in a minute. I agree. I'm not saying that everyone has that same call and obligation. I'm simply saying that in a particular moment in time and situation, that we may, as individuals within the context of a community, face a situation where it is an obligation of faith to respond in a certain way. And I still think that has to be done with all the checks of the community. And some of the stuff you're talking about is an option. I don't think that we're all called to the same to the same thing at all. And sometimes I can say, oh, no, isn't it? Anyway.
Other remarks?
I have a question for Barry or Maggie that troubles me a lot in terms of process when it comes to civil disobedience and tactics that, strictly speaking, pass beyond what would be defined, again, strictly as legal. In the case of what we've seen, well, let's say in the case of Watergate or in the case of the Contra-Iran affair, laws were broken, I think, in order to effect that policy. To resist that or the effects of that, I think, is not going outside of the law. It may be defined, or the sanctuary movement. You know, as I understand that, on the basis of the laws that are a part of this country, it is an obligation both in terms of the laws of this nation and the principles it stands on, and certainly within the range of freedom of communities, religious communities, to protect people who are victims of political oppression elsewhere. But now, how about if our government would pass legislation for more Contra aid? The people that voted this in are a majority of those that we have elected to office. Or how about those darn missile silos? Again, that has been, they've been constructed through processes of law which we acknowledge as part of a democracy. Now, this is not a rhetorical question. It's a genuine that I've struggled with a great deal. It may sound rhetorical, but please, it's not. If we now, in the case of policies and laws that have been the product, as far as we can see, of proper and constitutional processes, if we choose to break them, and I think that's what withholding tax involves, for example, is there any danger that we're operating on principles similar to Oliver North in bypassing structures that are acknowledged as duly constituted?
Well, for one thing, Oliver North maintains that he hasn't broken any laws.
We'll see about that.
Yeah, maybe in the end he'll change his song. But I think one component of civil disobedience that hasn't been brought out yet, but that people like Gandhi and King employed, was that you have to be willing to suffer the consequences of your disobedience. That's an integral part of the process. And as far as what happens if Congress does pass a bill to fund the Contras again, due democratic process may appear to have been followed, but you have to remember that in Germany in the 1930s, that the Nazis were the, quote, legal government in Germany. And did that excuse the German people as a whole from responsibility for what finally happened? Well, the judgments at Nuremberg said no, it didn't.
Right down the line here.
My sense is in the whole situation of Nicaragua, as well as with the missile silos, maybe it would make more sense. I guess I like the symbols better rather than going and getting arrested at our congressperson's office, of maybe what would happen if Christians from the United States just said, no, we can't allow that killing to happen, and do like the Witness for Peace. What happens if the whole border of Nicaragua has those of us from the United States standing there saying, we will absorb that violence, we will not allow it to go beyond, we're going to take responsibility by standing in the way, or just putting our bodies in the way of the transport of weapons or the building of missile silos, always accepting the consequences and absorbing the violence, the whole concept of redemptive suffering. Maybe that's the most faithful response. Civil disobedience in this country, I think, is also it's a gift we have to offer the universal church, because it's been a way of operating in this country, from the Boston Tea Party to the women's vote. It's just women just kept going to jail, coming back, going to jail, being fed corn soup with worms in it, and going right back, and that was just, 60 some years ago, and women couldn't vote. The civil rights movement, ending slavery, those were all acts of civil disobedience. It's really part of our heritage. I think we just have to find ways of putting ourselves in the way of the evil, and again looking at absorbing that violence.
Well, I will disobey a civil government, a civil authority, because I have a norm or an authority which I feel stands over this authority, which is Washington, D.C., or London, or Amsterdam, whatever you call it. So my norms are not based on what the Constitution says, but I mean what my Bible would say, for instance. And I think you have the right at a certain moment to say, I have a conscience which objects to what is going on, and I'm going to disobey it.
Many people redefine civil disobedience as holy obedience. You know, when the laws of God conflict with the laws of the land, we follow the laws of God.
Now, Barry, Jack, and Sarah.
I'm glad I got in before you two. I have several things to say to that, Paul. I think maybe you came in maybe after I...
No, I heard you. I didn't hear Maggie,
okay,
but someone filled me in, so I feel
okay.
Like more.
Well, because first of all, I would agree that I think you really do have to be very careful and very reflective about just starting to break laws. I mean, there's a reason for having some order in this state, and laws are necessary, and I think that just, again, to trivialize those is misdirected. At the same time, I would say that several things, specifically about the contra-aid stuff, I think that one has to question whether or not the democratic process is really working. For 4 years, national polls show that 70% of the American people oppose contra-aid, yet we still, our Congress still votes it. One has to question whether the information that we get is true. I think we're being lied to. So maybe the votes are there, but that is not a full democratic process that is happening. I think the same thing happens with arms, the arms race. I'm becoming less and less willing to accept the fact that our democratic process really works the way that we think it does. And so that I think is a response to your sense that, you know, if you have a democratic process that votes something in, that you have to be you should be hesitant about breaking laws. I'm not willing to buy that. I think that, I mean, you know, I've been to Nicaragua. There are a lot of other people here who have been. I know that what 90% of what we get from our government is not true. So that's the first thing. And I think that even if you want to accept democratic process, then the question is, are there not times when the majority oppresses the minority? I mean, that happens all through history, even when you have an open voting system. If you have a minority of people, blacks in this country for a long time still are, but even within the democratic structures were blatantly discriminated against, and that was simply a fact that there were more whites, the majority were voting, or the blacks didn't have a vote for that matter. So, and then the third thing I would add is basically what Maggie and John have already said, is I think at some point then you still have a moral obligation to a law which is higher.
I'm watching the clock here, and so if you have something to say, put your hand up soon, and we'll take them in order. It's a habit around here to call an official halt to the forum at 10 o'clock and then just let it go on for as long as it might go on among those who want to stay. But that means that anyone who wants to leave at 10 o'clock leaves with benediction and blessing.
Well, I was going to say two things. First of all, for your comment, Paul, I think that the typical conversation about civil disobedience, people are really talking about being nonviolent, and I see Oliver North doing is spreading violence. I mean, to fund terrorists in Central America doesn't seem to be answering a call of nonviolence that God calls us to. And I've also been thinking a lot about what you've been saying, Mark, and just how, you know, all of us aren't cut out for everything. But I think it is true that as Christians, we should all be called to martyrdom. Not that, what I say is martyrdom is what you have to do or somebody else has to do, but I think that we do have to discern that for ourselves. And I think, you said we're not all called to martyrdom, and I think we are. If we're really trying to, you know, Christ tells us to pick up the cross and follow him. And so I take that pretty seriously. It's scary as it is going.
Can I just say one word in response to what I think are very legitimate points, and I couldn't agree more with the position you're advancing with regard to civil disobedience. But the other side that I'm suggesting, I think, is equally radical. Because you're saying that the system isn't working, it's breaking down. And I think that challenges us on another very fundamental level. What's wrong here when, if we have that kind of result in polls, we elect people such as we have? What happens if we are only getting 10% of the correct information from a place like Nicaragua that asks questions about our press system? We're supposed to have freedom of press. We're supposed to get knowledge. We shouldn't depend on the government for our information about Nicaragua. And yet the channels, the major networks and things, are also not giving us accurate news. So it is calling into question some fundamental constitutional flaws, and that's a tremendous challenge in terms of education of our populace, what the church represents, to try to call people to priorities so that when they vote for the right reasons. You see what I say? I'm saying, I think with Mark that there are a lot of other ways of acting radically in this country, and we must see that with these different gifts, we're working together, those that are breaking laws for the reasons of the higher law, and also those that are trying to preach repentance to the nation in order to lead to more responsible voting in of public officials.
As long as we can also see that possibly civil disobedience can be a way of furthering the democratic process and not undermining it. I think
so
that's really
important. Pulling together, you know,
as long as there's other ways of doing that too.
That a lot of people who feel deeply that there are problems feel that those that are engaged in civil disobedience aren't part of their cause. And there is a split among people that should be allies.
Right.
So again, that's why I suggested the communal dimension to all of this, so that we have forums within our churches where we should be free to disagree, because we're all under the sovereign one, who is our only unity, and hammer these things out and then agree to embrace different tactics, but for the same reasons.
Yeah, and going along with what Paul said, you know, if democracy isn't working, then what will work? I think that's why a lot of civil disobedience movements lose credibility, because they say this is wrong, but okay, so what do we do about it? I mean, give the governments more answers, give other options, you know, think it through. Don't just say it's wrong. Don't slam everything about our government before you have a better way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Kind of unrelated, I'm sorry. It's a question that I have to struggle with. I'm a college student, and I get to study back 15, 20 years ago when colleges were, according to the book anyhow, they were kind of the thrust of the civil disobedience. And I was able to participate in a sort of civil disobedience specifically from 2 years ago concerning divestment. Was wonderful. Organization is very important, as we found out. But the point that I'm trying to ask, I guess, and maybe I just need a little encouragement or something, but is there as much of an opportunity for college students now as then? Is it as appropriate now as it is then? Are there people supporting people like me who haven't been able to really find, and maybe I haven't been looking hard enough, the opportunities to organize or participate on a college campus, or is that too broad a question? I guess, Maggie, since you, you have...
Yeah. Well, I think it's important and it's essential. I don't know why this is happening on college campuses, why there's been a real kind of political shift or a real hesitancy to get involved.
There's been a political shift. The students on the campuses are are voting with their parents who voted Ronald Reagan in as the United States President, and they are not about to do the civil disobedience or even make the demonstrations on the campus right now that they did in the past.
Well, to be fully fair to the students today are coming in. They cannot get fellowships or scholarships.
Right.
They have to take out loans. It's much more expensive than it used to be. One of the things that Reagan has done by removing money from the schools is essentially subverted a whole generation of students who have to worry about paying for their education by the time they get out.
Is it
I don't approve of it, but that's what...
It's either national or state law where can you not attend a state-funded school unless you have registered for the draft.
You can't get loans.
I think in Colorado they're trying to extend that even further, where if you are not registered, you cannot attend a state-funded school. There's a lot of heated discussion about that.
Right. It is 10 o'clock. I appreciate this kind of question because it has reflected the kinds of questions that have been here all night, namely that for the most part we have addressed this forum question by being quite concrete, talking about very particular instances, and that's the only way we can properly address it. If you took the question as it is stated, the answer is a straightforward yes. That is to say, I don't know of any generation of Christians that would not have said civil disobedience is an option or obligation for Christians. That's been the case from right to left. It might mean smuggling Bibles into an Iron Curtain country, but Christians have always said yes in some form or another. If you took the same question and posed it to us as a member of, as a U.S. American citizen, the answer in every generation has also been yes. This country was born in civil disobedience and revolution, and we have treasured it as one of the legacies of freedom that needs to be nurtured. And when the protests occurred at the South African Embassy on disinvestment, Walter Fonkrey of the U.S. Congress was one of the instigators because it belonged to freedom of assembly and other freedom of speech and other things. So I think the answer there has also always been yes, but the answer doesn't get serious until we start talking about particular cases and issues and questions, and the forum has done that. And I think it's been good, and you're all true. We could give one another collective round of applause, but that may not show proper humility, so we won't, but just know that we've done it. done a good job. I do think we ought to have another forum which really pushes the question, and that should be entitled Civil Obedience. Is it an obligation or an option for Christians? That's the way it was put until Constantine. We put the question after Constantine.